This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. QAnon is a group that believes in a host of far-fetched, baseless conspiracy theories, including that a cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles runs a child sex trafficking ring. According to QAnon, the Democrats are in on it, and President Trump is trying to save the children. Two dozen candidates this election cycle are followers, including Republican Marjorie Douglas Greene, who is very likely to win a House seat in Georgia next month. Fake conspiracy theories about children getting trafficked are now getting in the way of real efforts to fight human trafficking. Here to tell us about it is Megan Cutter. She's the acting director of the U.S. National Human Trafficking Hotline. That's a program operated by Polaris, a nonprofit that works to combat human trafficking and modern-day slavery. Megan, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here with you.
So QAnon is easy for some folks to fall into because who doesn't want to save children from sexual abuse? But let's be clear here. Is there any truth to QAnon conspiracies about the trafficking of children?
You know, that's such a good question, and I think something that a lot of folks are wondering about. And at Polaris, what we are aware of is that so far these are unproven and that they're actually taking away from the discourse around how trafficking really happens and the ways in which traffickers exploit vulnerable individuals. And so for us, that's what's really important to focus on, is the actual ways in which trafficking is really happening and the realities, particularly of how sex trafficking happens and how we can prevent it.
What are some big misconceptions about human trafficking that QAnon perpetuates?
Great question. The first that I would emphasize is that the misconception that the way that trafficking happens is that children are trafficked by strangers most of the time, particularly that people are kidnapping children off of the street in violent, extreme ways. Of course, that unfortunately does happen, but it is much, much rarer than a situation of what we typically see, where a trusted adult, an adult who has gained the trust of a child, perhaps of their family, of others in their lives, through a process of grooming and through recruitment, maybe even love and trust, and has then coerced or compelled the child to engage in sex acts for money or for drugs or something else of value, which would be human trafficking. And so that's a big one that we really want to clear up, because I think in order for parents, for caregivers, for loved ones to keep their children safe, the best thing to do is to be aware of how trafficking really happens and to identify ways to help your child when maybe even a trusted, loved person in their life does something that they're uncomfortable with or that feels unsafe, that they know who to talk to and who to ask for help from. So that's a big one. Another one is that this idea that all children are equally at risk for trafficking, that this could happen to anyone. And what we at Polaris want to emphasize is that trafficking is a symptom of other societal ills. So some children are going to be more vulnerable to being exploited than others. And that's because of things like a history of abuse or having experienced trauma, maybe being in an unstable living situation or things like that. So in order to fight trafficking, we actually have to look at the systems that enable it, such as poverty, systemic racism, things of that nature, in order to really get at the root cause of how this crime happens.
Meg, how are these conspiracies impacting your work?
Another great question, and this has been a challenge both for Polaris and also for other victim services organizations across the country. The National Human Trafficking Hotline for the past few months has been receiving many, many, many reports of the same information, most of which is publicly available, which is based on these viral online social media reports or things online that are publicly available. And the folks that are reaching out to us are genuinely concerned, but they don't have any direct knowledge of the trafficking situations that they're reporting. They're reporting something that is on the news or that they saw on Facebook, not from a victim or survivor or someone reaching out for help. And so what that means is that it's overwhelming the services that are available for victims and survivors. It might mean that when someone calls a resource like the National Human Trafficking Hotline and they're genuinely looking for help and they're hoping to exit their trafficking situation or report something, that they have to wait on hold because the lines are being flooded by folks reporting this viral misinformation. And so that's a big piece of it. And it's been really challenging for folks in the movement across the country, and something that at Polaris we've really been grappling with the past few months.
What steps have you taken to get around the problem of especially false tips on your hotlines?
Yeah, one of the big things that we've been trying to do is to be really proactive about the communications about how trafficking really happens. So Polaris has published a couple blog posts about this. One that I think is particularly helpful for folks is called What We Know About How Sex Trafficking Happens, or Child Sex Trafficking Happens, rather. And it talks about the ways in which trafficking exploits vulnerable individuals in their communities, and how parents can talk to their kids about online safety, about what grooming looks like, about how this actually works, and then also encourages people to support local organizations where they are that are working to prevent child sex trafficking and working to support survivors. So one of the big things has been trying to educate the public on, you're right, this is a really concerning issue. Here's how it really happens, and here's how you can really help. Because we do believe that the majority of the folks who are concerned from a place that is very genuine and very real. And so we want them to have the right information, correct, accurate information from experts about how they can keep themselves and their families safe, and also how they can support those in their communities who may be vulnerable to trafficking.
Well, we got this Facebook comment from Laurel who says, I've had several friends post things or believe things that are obviously from the QAnon playbook, but they weren't aware of the larger narrative. It's insidious how it uses kernels of truth, manipulate it with lots of falsehoods to play on people's emotions or to make them feel like they are in the know. What's the best way people who are concerned about missing children can truly help victims of human trafficking without accidentally stumbling into conspiracy land?
Such an important question. And I know that's something I've seen on my own social media feeds as well. So I sympathize with that. I think that one thing is to educate yourself about how trafficking really happens from trusted sources. So places like Polaris, where you can look at our website and see information about how the crime really occurs. But then also recognizing that what we believe is the best way to identify trafficking in your community is to think about situations in which you might have context and proximity. So you might have individuals that you are close to, that you know, where you are concerned about them because you know what's normal for their situation and you're seeing that that's shifting or that's changing. And then you have that context around, maybe it's changing because someone is abusing or harming them. So there's a lot of great information about that, about kind of understanding how to identify trafficking with those close to you, and identifying the ways in which it could be happening in your community, rather than, I think, focusing on these sensationalized stories, but recognizing the ways in which this crime occurs. So those would be a few recommendations. I think this blog post about how child sex trafficking really happens, which can be found on Polaris's website, is a really good place to start because it has some tangible recommendations for folks.
Well, Richard Wexler tweets, quote, "The Huffington Post has written that mainstream anti-trafficking groups helped cause the QAnon problem because they misrepresent the realities in order to raise awareness. When will they take responsibility for that?" How do you respond to someone like Richard who says part of the problem is that maybe some of these cases have been misrepresented?
That's a good point. And I think the way that I would respond to that is to recognize that the trafficking field has evolved over the years and has gotten more precise about how we encourage people to identify trafficking, how we encourage people to support victims and survivors. And so one of the ways in which we encourage people to do that is to really think about restoring autonomy to victims and survivors and allowing them to, especially particularly for adults, to report their own situations and to seek help for themselves and to support adults in doing that and in making those choices. But I think that's a good and important point to consider for sure.
That was Megan Cutter, acting director of the U.S. National Human Trafficking Hotline. Megan, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we're going to take a closer look at the roots of QAnon, how it spreads on social media, in part by drawing on the good intentions of people who want to save the children. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Google. Since 2017, Google has helped 5 million Americans learn digital skills through Grow with Google. With Google's free Applied Digital Skills courses, job seekers can expand their skill sets, boost their resumes, and power their job searches. And with Google Career Certificates, people can learn job-ready skills to start or advance their careers in high-demand fields like IT support with no prior experience required. Get tools and resources to grow your career at google.com/grow.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
I'm Rodney Carmichael.
I'm Sydney Madden.
And on our new podcast, Louder Than a Riot, we trace the collision of rhyme and punishment in America.
We were hunted by police. We were literally physically hunted. You'd be standing on the corner, drug squad pull up, everybody would run.
New from NPR Music. Listen to Louder Than a Riot.
I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're talking about QAnon, and joining us now to talk about the roots of the conspiracy and what social media companies are doing about it are Ben Collins, a reporter with NBC News that covers conspiracies, including QAnon. Ben, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also with us, Kevin Roos, a technology columnist for The New York Times. Kevin, it's great to have you.
Glad to be here.
Kevin, how much influence does QAnon have, and how has it shifted since the pandemic began?
Well, it's hard to quantify. I mean, QAnon doesn't exactly keep a membership database, but we can see just through tracking certain Facebook groups, YouTube channels, Twitter hashtags, that this movement has really expanded since the pandemic. I mean, I think that tracks with sort of common sense. If people are stuck indoors, away from their social connections, they're going to be spending more of their time developing relationships on the internet, finding new things to talk about and think about. So QAnon has really filled a void for a lot of people during the pandemic, but the explosion of membership in these groups has been really something to watch. It's not just that these groups are growing by 10, 20, 30%. It's 500%, 600%, 1,000% since the start of the pandemic.
And how are we starting to see some of this show up in government?
Well, we've already seen, as was mentioned previously, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a presumed sort of winner of the House race in Georgia's 14th congressional district, is a diehard QAnon supporter going back several years. We also have dozens of other candidates running for office at the federal and state levels around the country. And this has actually expanded outside the U.S. too. There are now far-right extremists in Germany and the U.K. who have sort of adopted QAnon as a rallying cry.
Ben, when did we see QAnon start embedding themselves into the real problem of child sex trafficking?
It's sort of embedded into the start of QAnon. You know, one of the first few posts was about satanic ritual abuse, which, you know, they believe that there is a cabal of people in the world that are sacrificing people to Satan. And they are, it's prominent Democrats and Hollywood elites and all this stuff. So this isn't the first few posts of QAnon. Now, when did it really take off in terms of, public acceptance of this sort of thing? It's really when it reached Instagram and got out of the hands of, traditional QAnon people. For a long time, traditional QAnon people were boomers, people, in their 40s and 50s who were relatively new to the internet, who were new to conspiracy theories on the internet, and didn't know that all information isn't equal. But then it really kind of took off once it reached Instagram with what a lot of researchers call it pastel QAnon. It adopted the aesthetics of wellness brands and people who sell crystals on the internet and stuff. It looked very pretty. However, the messages were about Satan and they were about kidnapping children and stuff. So that reached a whole new audience, suburban moms, rural moms. And that's when it really started to take off this summer in the middle of the pandemic.
You know, Kevin, QAnon doesn't just attract people who are prone to believing far-fetched conspiracies. You know, we got this Facebook question from Stephen who says, what has happened to people to make them susceptible to believing in these conspiracies? Facebook can ban their disinformation, which is a good thing. But how do people start supporting QAnon? Because I think on its face, when you hear some of these conspiracies, they sound so outlandish, and yet they've taken root. Do we know what's at work there?
Well, I think QAnon has been very strategic in how it recruits people. It sort of builds these ideological on-ramps so that you don't have to jump all the way to the stuff about, you know, Satan and sacrificing children to Moloch and whatever. They have these sort of groups where it's just about saving the children. And who doesn't agree with saving the children? I mean, that's a pretty uncontroversial statement. So people get into it through that, or they see something in their parenting Facebook group or their wellness group, or they follow someone on Instagram who starts posting about, you know, child sex trafficking. And it starts off pretty uncontroversial. And then there's this kind of slope that leads people pretty quickly down into the real sort of core beliefs of QAnon, which is the stuff about sacrificing and eating children. So that's sort of how people get into it. And as far as why people get into it, I mean, I think as with a lot of conspiracy theories, QAnon really fills a void for people. It's not just a conspiracy theory. It's also a community. It's people who all go on the internet, hang out together, discuss their latest theories, make friends. Like, it is a participatory media-making collaboration. And I think that's what separates it from earlier forms of this conspiracy theory, is that you can participate. If you are, you know, a believer in QAnon, you can be part of this community of people who go on the internet and discuss these totally bogus claims.
Ben, we got this tweet from Douglas who says, the only thing worse than those believing in conspiracy theories is those overly worried about them. Is the concern about QAnon overblown?
You know, that's a really good question. It's something that we worry about all the time. I think, you know, Kevin and I worry about this constantly on our beat, where, you know, is the fact that we're talking about it amplifying it? But what we've realized is just ask around. Ask your friends and family, because you know somebody who believes in this stuff or is dipping their toe in it. And it sort of saturates our politics in a way that isn't one-to-one. Just because somebody is not necessarily like a law, like a card-carrying QAnon guy, doesn't mean he's not retweeting their conspiracy theories. For example, yesterday, the president of the United States tweeted a conspiracy theory from a QAnon account that said Barack Obama accidentally ordered the killing of Osama bin Laden's body double. This is a QAnon-based conspiracy theory, but it's not. It wasn't sent by Q. It wasn't a QAnon thing. It had nothing to do with, you know, child sex trafficking. But they create a different world in which we have to focus on expelling all of these ridiculous conspiracy theories instead of the real stuff that is happening, because those the people in power are the people pushing this and making this stuff, this fictitious stuff, the stuff we have to talk about instead of, you know, stuff like climate change or things that are, you know, actual threats to our way of life.
We're going to pause our conversation with Ben and Kevin for a second to check in with Representative Tom Mulinowski, a Democrat from New Jersey. He recently sponsored legislation to formally condemn QAnon. It passed in the House 371-18. Representative, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Why was it important for you to introduce this bill?
My hope was that we could achieve an overwhelming bipartisan condemnation of QAnon and these conspiracy theories that it is amplifying and spreading so widely in our country right now, without any illusions. I understand that people who are sucked into this conspiracy mindset are not going to suddenly wake up and see the light because Congress has condemned it. But especially in light of the fact that the president of the United States, the leader of one of our major political parties, is amplifying QAnon conspiracy theories, I wanted to show that overwhelmingly Republicans as well as Democrats reject this nonsense. And we achieved that.
After passing that bill to condemn QAnon, you became the target of death threats from QAnon supporters. What has it been like dealing with that?
well, I guess I'm not surprised by basically turning people against the government, against institutions, against facts, does encourage at its fringes violent behavior. And so, yeah, I guess when you're the guy who leads Congress in condemning it, some of its members are going to notice and they're going to react in that way. What was uniquely disturbing about the situation is that the Q persona itself, and here I'm referring to whoever is putting out messages under the name of Q, and I, of course, don't believe that it's someone deep in the U.S. government who is, you know, who is alerting us to all of these so-called truths. But whoever is controlling that persona put out to all the Q followers a screenshot of the resolution that I had introduced, but also a screenshot of a Republican political attack against me in my congressional campaign in New Jersey, an attack that really does play to the same paranoid theories that QAnon promotes. And those two things together triggered the death threats.
Do you think the federal government has done enough to condemn QAnon?
Well, we have two main branches of the federal government here, and Congress has now spoken, again, overwhelmingly, and I think that's important. But the leader of the executive branch has also spoken in ways that I think signal to QAnon supporters that they may be onto something. He's not just retweeting QAnon-style conspiracy theories. By doing so, I think he's playing into the conspiracy theory. He is suggesting to them that he may, in fact, be the hero of their fictitious story, rooting out the so-called deep state cabal from our government, and I think that's profoundly dangerous. Others, of course, in the executive branch and in the FBI and our national security agencies are very much onto this, and they understand and have said that that QAnon poses a very significant potential threat. The FBI has said that that the promotion of crazy conspiracy theories, anti-government conspiracy theories by groups like QAnon does pose a terrorist threat to the homeland. And there have been a number of violent acts committed by QAnon followers that the FBI has cited as evidence.
That's Congressman Tom Malinowski, a Democrat from New Jersey. Thanks for your time. Coming up, Facebook recently disabled more than 500 QAnon groups on its platform. Is that enough or is it too little, too late? I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Swell. Swell is a place for thoughtful audio conversations that are unlike anything you've experienced. Interact with authors, celebrity chefs, teachers, artists, CEOs, or connect with new people from all over the world. Listen on Swell for fresh ideas and perspectives. And once you're comfortable with the app, start a new conversation by posting a Swell of your own. Swell is free in the App Store and on Google Play. From technologists to podcasters, interesting people are talking on Swell.
Billie Holiday helped shape American music with her voice and unique style.
But her legacy extends way beyond music, with one song in particular.
How Strange Fruit became an unexpected hit and brought on serious consequences for Billie Holiday.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White. And we're back talking about the rise of QAnon and what social media companies have done about it with Ben Collins, a reporter with NBC News, and Kevin Roos, a technology columnist for the New York Times. Now, we've mentioned a couple of times that QAnon supporters are now running for office, including Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who's likely to win a House seat. And here's a clip from her primary victory speech where she promotes baseless, totally false conspiracy theories about the billionaire philanthropist George Soros.
If you love this country and want to stop radical, hate America people like George Soros from destroying it, they're going to call you an anti-Semite.
Yeah.
Do not accept it.
Nope.
Do not apologize.
That's right.
And do not back down.
And again, this is an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory and not true, but it's important to point out the liberal advocacy group Media Matters for America showed 81 QAnon supporters running for Congress, with 24 qualified to be on the ballot. But Ben, talk a bit about where George Soros falls into these conspiracies.
So he is this unseen hand. He is, when they talk about Joe Biden as a puppet for somebody, they're talking about George Soros, or generally they're talking about, you know, the cabal. And the cabal to them is inherently, you know, all the things that you would think to be evil. And to them, Jewish is one of those things. So he has, you know, this unseen power in the QAnon universe, where he's not just funding the cabal, but he's funding the protests from over the summer. He's funding any sort of event or action all throughout the world. He's funding Antifa to them. Anytime there is, you know, a U-Haul, for example, there was this famous thing that QAnon was really obsessed with. There was a $30 U-Haul rented for one of these protests. And, you know, they pushed this conspiracy theory that George Soros was behind that. I don't know why you would need to call George Soros to rent a U-Haul, but that's what it's like in that universe, is that, you know, every event that goes wild in the right-wing universe that could conceivably involve money, he is behind it. So he's their boogeyman, and that boogeyman in their world is the guy pulling the strings behind Joe Biden. It's a classic trope, but it's just been reinvented through QAnon.
Well, Ben, this is something you touched on earlier, but in the interest of full disclosure, as a team here at 1A, we debated whether to even play a clip of Green touting these theories. As media, what do we do when it comes to addressing QAnon, with the understanding that even playing a clip and saying this isn't true, this is a conspiracy, it still gives it more air and more sunlight?
Yeah, it's always a problem with us. We're always trying to figure out where that line is. It's called, you know, in with extremism and disinformation researchers, they call it the oxygen of amplification. You know, if you give it oxygen, it inherently just blows up a little bit. You have to counteract it with facts. You know, when I work with my colleague Brandi Zadrozny at NBC, and we have this sort of, like, I don't know, motto or something, that if we cover this stuff, we have to cover the money behind it. We have to cover the people who are benefiting from this sort of thing, or we have to cover the victims of it. We have to cover people who have been personally affected by this stuff. So for every time you hear Marjorie Taylor Greene say something that is outlandish like that, you have to show the person who is affected by that sort of thing. Because then you can show that this is not just, you know, somebody saying stuff on the internet, that there are lives being torn apart by this. There are families who are being torn apart, quite literally. Divorces have been attributed to this. You know, people not talking to their parents anymore. You know, it's a cult. It has cult dynamics. And because of that, it's not just, you know, the murders attributed to this and the violent acts. It's also these, like, little tiny aggressions on society that QAnon is taking out and really tearing our social fabric apart.
Well, we also heard from Megyn Cutter earlier about how it's affecting people who are actually doing this work to try to prevent child sex trafficking, tying up resources that are needed. Kevin, QAnon followers spread their message through social media, and we heard the representative talk about some of the algorithms at work. Explain a little bit more about how this is playing out.
Sure. So all this is with the caveat that some of these networks, including Facebook, have taken action against QAnon in recent weeks. But before that, for years and years, the way that these QAnon groups would recruit people is they would start taking things off of the message boards where they were originally posted, putting them into private Facebook groups, and then growing those Facebook groups with the help of Facebook's recommendations algorithm. Facebook, you know, if you've ever, you know, sort of joined a group on Facebook, it'll say, here are some other groups you might want to join. Here are some things that are similar to your interests that you may be interested in. And so people were joining those. And that was a big part of how they were able to reach such a scale so quickly, is that these algorithms were basically supercharging their recruiting efforts and going out and finding vulnerable people for them without them having to do anything. So if you were part of a, you know, natural health group, it might recommend an anti-vaccine group. And then if you joined that anti-vaccine group, it might recommend a QAnon group. This happened over and over and over again for millions of people. And all, you know, I don't think the social networks intended to do this, but through the use of their tools, these movements were able to grow quite quickly.
Kevin, Facebook has just recently taken steps to crack down on QAnon, as you said, and ban them from the platform after years of pressure to do so. What took so long? Why now?
Well, I think they, you know, they have a lot on their plate, obviously. There's an election coming up. And I think if you talk to people, you know, at Facebook, they will tell you there is some internal resistance to doing more speech censorship than they need to keep people safe. And I think what they've said is that they've seen a sort of worrisome uptick in violent rhetoric and action surrounding these communities. And so that's why they decided to act. But I have to emphasize here, I'm glad that Facebook is doing something to try to curb the growth of QAnon, but it's not, it's really late in the game. I mean, to use a metaphor, like, it's not just that the horse has already left the barn. The horse has radicalized your mom, run for Congress, and organized a Save the Baby Horses rally. These groups are enormous, and yeah, they will have a harder time recruiting people now that they are banned from Facebook. But Facebook had an opportunity to do something about this years ago, and it didn't do it. And I think we're going to be seeing the effects of that for a long time.
Kevin, has there been a response from these QAnon groups?
Yeah, many of them that I've been watching are sort of scrambling to figure out where we go next, which platforms will let us, you know, exist there, how can we sort of move our conversation into a more secure environment. And I do think it is really hampering their ability to keep this movement going. There are still platforms that allow, you know, QAnon content on them, including some big ones. But I think that the movement is having to sort of regroup and reformulate a strategy. And I think it's going to be a real problem for them going forward.
Kevin, we talked a lot about Facebook and how they've been handling this. But what about other social media sites, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram? What are we seeing there?
So Instagram is owned by Facebook, and they are obeying. They're following along with Facebook's guidelines about banning QAnon entirely. Twitter and YouTube have taken some steps to limit the spread of QAnon content. YouTube says it is classified QAnon content as borderline content, which almost violates its rules but doesn't technically violate its rules, and that they've reduced its visibility. Twitter has removed a bunch of QAnon accounts and has said that it will ban people for engaging in coordinated harassment campaigns, which is a big part of what people on QAnon in QAnon use Twitter for. So they've taken some steps to limit the visibility of this content, but it's still out there. It's not strictly against their rules to post about QAnon, and so that's sort of still a sort of somewhat safe place for QAnon believers to congregate.
Ben, what do we do? You can't necessarily be over, you know, that loved one's shoulder all the time, watching what they're looking at on Facebook or stopping them from posting things. But just as individuals, are there steps we can take to try to prevent the growth of this?
When you talk to researchers of QAnon and generally cults, because that's what this is, you know, they say it works a lot better to do this preventatively. You know, to tell them, you know, this is ridiculous. You're escaping reality early on, because once they're already down the rabbit hole, they will. Part of QAnon is to reject reality. To be in the in-group, you have to reject all mainstream and real sources of information. So you have to get to them before all that happens. You have to remind them, hey, we're, you know, generally people are trying to do the right thing here. Remember that. Remember that we're people, and that, you know, these people don't have these supernatural powers. They're not super heroically evil. They're not, you know, classic villains from like comic books. Once you can do that, you can start to, you know, create a defense mechanism. But there's no real antidote for this that doesn't involve direct intervention from like psychiatric care. Like, that's what we've seen over and over again. It takes so much work. De-radicalizing QAnon people is like de-radicalizing people in like the Nexium cult or Scientology or something. It takes a tremendous amount of work and effort. So get to them early and remember, tell them, like, look, times are tough. It's a really difficult time, but we can get through this together. And there's not going to be one solution where you get rid of a group of people and it's all over with. We're going to get through this as a country. We're going to get through this as friends and family.
That was Ben Collins, a reporter with NBC News. He covers conspiracies, including QAnon, and Kevin Roos, a technology columnist for The New York Times. Thanks to you both. This conversation was produced by Katie Klein and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.